Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
Stream the new Paramount Plus original series, Fatal Attraction.
I didn't think that this is what we were doing.
What were we doing?
Starring Joshua Jackson, Lizzie Kaplan.
I'm not going to be ignored, Dan.
Fatal Attraction, now streaming exclusively on Paramount Plus.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Nick Miles, and at 13 hours GMT on Friday, the 12th of May, these are our main stories. A court in Pakistan has ordered the release of the opposition leader Imran Khan on bail, days after his detention sparked major unrest. Elon Musk says Twitter has a new chief executive, but won't say who she is. We examine claims from the UN that Malian troops and foreign military personnel killed more than 500 people in an attack. Also in this podcast, the dangers of being a political dissident in Laos. New York City bans discrimination on the grounds of weight or height. And
all the things I could have done that day, all the parties I could have gone to, but I chose to attend the coronation and I got to see none of it.
Caught up among protesters, a royal fan says she was detained for being an innocent bystander at the coronation. We start in Pakistan, where Islamabad's High Court has ordered the release of Imran Khan, who was arrested earlier this week. The former Prime Minister was granted 2 weeks' protected bail after appearing in court related to a corruption case and other charges. Our correspondent Caroline Davies has just sent this report from inside the court complex.
In a dramatic intervention, the High Court in Islamabad gave Imran Khan 2 weeks' bail on the very case he'd been arrested for on Tuesday from this court complex. A judge also allowed bail until next Wednesday on all cases registered against the former Prime Minister while he was in police custody. That stands within Islamabad. It's not clear whether Mr. Khan could be arrested if he left the capital. Imran Khan was defiant in court, saying he'd been treated as a terrorist. His opponents say he's been using his supporters to avoid the law. When asked whether he would tell his supporters to stop any violent attacks, Mr. Khan said he'd always called for peaceful protests, but that he could not be held responsible for any action that happened if he's arrested again.
Sahar Baluch is from the BBC's Urdu service in Lahore, and she gave us some context to the court case.
Imran Khan wanted elections. He wanted general elections to happen in Pakistan. This all started when Imran Khan was kicked out of the parliament as a result of a no-confidence vote against him in the parliament. He was the Prime Minister of Pakistan in 2022. In April, his government was removed. And since then, he's been congregating a lot of people across Pakistan saying that there was a conspiracy against his rule. There was a U.S. conspiracy. Earlier, he accused the U.S. of conspiring against him. Then he said that the Prime Minister of Pakistan, Mr. Shehbaz Sharif, is against him. And then later in the year, when there was an assassination attempt against his life, which he calls assassination attempt, he also once again accused the current government of conspiring against him. So this had been going on for a while. He kept on saying that just because he confronted the army chief of the time, as you know that in Pakistan, a lot of these things, a lot of political things are decided in some way. They are sort of alleged to be decided by the military establishment. So as a result of that confrontation, Imran Khan was removed. A lot of people believe that he used to be military establishment's blue-eyed boy in the beginning, as a result of which a lot of people say that he also got into parliament as well. So since that confrontation with the army chief, he was removed. And since then, there are these cases against him. And most of these cases are on corruption charges. Mind you, Imran Khan also started his election campaign saying that he will go after the corrupt officials, especially his political rivals like the Pakistan People's Party and the Pakistan Muslim League Nawaz.
That was Sahar Baluch. Now to Mali and what human rights groups are describing as the worst atrocity so far in the ongoing war between Islamist groups and the army. UN human rights investigators say Malian troops and foreign military personnel, widely believed to be the Russian mercenary group Wagner, killed more than 500 people in a village last year. Our Africa editor is Richard Hamilton.
The survivors who have spoken to the United Nations say that a military helicopter flew over the village, started shooting at people, and then four other helicopters arrived. Soldiers disembarked, and started shooting at more people. And then witnesses say that over the next 4 days, at least 500 people were summarily executed. They go on to say that, as you say, that it was armed white men speaking an unfamiliar language who were involved. Soldiers would go from house to house searching for what they called presumed terrorists. So they selected people, for example, who had long beards or wore ankle-length trousers, or even people that just showed signs of fear. And then witnesses also said that men were rounded up, taken to a river, shot in the head, back or chest, and their bodies were thrown into a ditch. At least 58 women and girls were raped or subjected to sexual violence. And many, many people were tortured. So, as you say, pretty gruesome details.
Yeah, and there are suggestions that members of this Russian mercenary group, Wagner, were involved. Can you tell us more about their involvement in Mali?
It's always been a bit murky. Experts believe that Wagner are involved in about half a dozen African countries, including Sudan, most recently. Mali initially denied reports that Wagner were ever involved, but then it became harder to maintain that line. So they later said that the Russians were instructors and didn't have direct combat role. But that also is hard to maintain. If we go back to why this all happened, the instability caused by the Libyan civil war was exploited by Islamists who took over the north of Mali in 2012. And then the French intervened the next year and successfully pushed them back. But since then, there's been a lot of frustration with the failure to deal with the Islamists. And that resulted in a military coup in 2021. And then Emmanuel Macron officially withdrew all the French troops. So now Mali is turning very much to Moscow. And as we see here, or allegedly, the Wagner uses a very blunt approach and they don't distinguish between civilians and militant Islamists. They just try and kill lots of people. So it's a sort of blanket approach. And experts and analysts are saying this may just fuel more anger and disenchantment and fuel more Islamism.
That was Richard Hamilton. There is little room for political opposition or dissenting voices in communist-ruled Laos, one of Asia's poorest countries. But Anusa Luang Supom, also known as Jack, is one of them. Last month, he survived an assassination attempt, and it is now known that he has left the country to receive urgent medical care. The Laotian authorities have blamed the attack on a personal or business dispute, but his associates believe that he was targeted by an undercover police officer. Our Asia-Pacific editor, Celia Hatton, told me more.
It really is an incredible story, Nick. So Jack, as he's known by the community, by his family and friends, he's 25. He survived a point-blank shooting. A man walked into a cafe where Jack was with his friends the night of April 30th and shot him at very close range in the chest and in the face. The gunman left. His family then decided it would be safest if they spread the news that he died in the attack. So about a week ago, I actually wrote a story saying that this famous high-profile blogger had died. It then came out a day later that no, he'd survived the attack and he was being cared for in hospital, but his family and friends were very concerned about him. And now I've just got the news a few hours ago from his representatives that he has actually escaped Laos to another country. They're not releasing the location of where he is because they're still worried about his safety. That's how repressive Laos is. Even activists who've escaped Laos have disappeared years later. And so that's why there's still so much concern about him.
And just remind us specifically what kind of things he's said. How outspoken has he been about the things going on in Laos?
He ran two community Facebook pages that spoke about all sorts of things: corruption inside Laos, environmental pollution problems, gay rights. Jack is a very proud gay man, which is incredibly unusual. And so really, there's no one really like him at the moment, or there wasn't inside Laos. He's now left the country. And his representatives say it's just unclear whether he's ever going to be able to return. He's still too sick at the moment to make that decision for himself. In fact, he had surgery yesterday to remove a bullet from his chest and to have surgery. You know, the second bullet actually passed through his cheek. And so he really is recovering in hospital right now. We're just going to have to see what's going to happen to him.
That was our Asia Pacific editor, Celia Hatton. Elon Musk's foray into the world of social media ownership has been fraught with difficulties, confusion over the purchase in the first place, and then controversy over how he sacked many on the payroll. For many months, Mr. Musk has said that he will hand over day-to-day running of Twitter to someone else. Now, he's tweeted that there will be a new chief executive without naming anyone, only saying that she would start in 6 weeks' time. Here's our Silicon Valley correspondent, James Clayton.
Well, first of all, I think it's important to mention that just because Elon Musk has tweeted something doesn't necessarily mean it's actually true. And you may remember I interviewed Elon Musk last month and I asked him who was going to be the next chief executive. And he told me he'd already made a dog chief executive. So it's sometimes difficult to know whether he's joking or not. It does seem like he's actually being serious this time. And that would be a really significant moment for Twitter. I mean, first of all, he said that the new chief executive is a she. I think that's really important because the vast majority of tech bosses in Silicon Valley and elsewhere are men. So that would be a very interesting development. And it'll be very interesting to know exactly what power the chief executive will have, because Elon Musk will still own the company, will still have a huge amount of power in the company. So is this more of a technocratic role where you're basically doing Elon Musk's bidding, or will they actually have genuine power? And that's a really interesting question. I think if you look at his other companies that he also has to run, it would suggest that Elon Musk would love to micromanage everything, but he just has too much on. So it may well be that the new chief executive actually does have real power. And if you look at the markets too, and their market reaction to this tweet, well, they think he's being serious because the Tesla share price has shot up at this news. Tesla shareholders were worried that Elon Musk was simply spending too much time on Twitter and not enough time working out how to make Tesla a better and bigger company. So there's lots to unpack here, but worth just mentioning once again, this is Elon Musk we're talking about. We don't know whether he's being serious. We don't know whether there will be a chief executive in 6 weeks' time, because you never quite know with Elon Musk.
James Clayton. Thousands of people from around the world lined the streets of London last Saturday to see the King and his coronation procession. But for one royal superfan, they saw none of the spectacle. And instead, Alice Chambers says that she was detained for being an innocent bystander and then held by the police for 13 hours. Ms. Chambers, who's originally from Australia but lives in London, told the BBC more about the ordeal in this report by Aruna Iyengar.
I was just sitting there waiting for the coronation to begin. And next minute I realised that the police had just swooped in and started grabbing a whole heap of people. They handcuffed me straight away and then pulled me out of the crowd and put me against a barrier with a whole heap of other protesters.
Not my king! Not my king!
Last Saturday, police made 64 arrests during the coronation, 52 related to concerns that people were going to disrupt the event.
We have the right to free speech!
Alice gave her contact details and showed her ID. It took 4 hours before she got to a police station.
I kept trying to explain that I just wasn't part of this group. I always tried to just think, oh, well, surely there's going to be someone soon that I can talk to that will just understand that this is all a misunderstanding. And that just didn't come, you know. I was detained for 13 hours.
Whilst all this was going on in London, Alice was giving police her DNA. Her photo and fingerprints were taken. It wasn't until 7 o'clock that evening that she was interviewed and released. An officer from Lincolnshire Police made the arrest. The force said a woman in her 30s was arrested in connection with a Just Stop Oil protest. She was subsequently released with no further action. We've now received a complaint and we are reviewing the incident. And we are in contact with the complainant to establish the full details of her allegations.
Oh, I mean, it's just been so shocking. I think about, you know, all the things I could have done that day, all the parties I could have gone to, but I chose to attend the coronation and I got to see none of it.
Alice Chambers, ending that report by Aruna Iyengar. Still to come in this podcast.
I'm just so happy to be alive. I'm just kind of taking in what just happened.
We find out why an American pilot deliberately crashed his own plane.
Paramount Plus original series, Fatal Attraction.
I didn't think that this is what we were doing.
What were we doing?
Starring Joshua Jackson, Lizzie Kaplan.
I'm not going to be ignored, Dan.
Fatal Attraction, now streaming exclusively on Paramount Plus.
To New York now, where legislation has been passed banning discrimination on the grounds of weight or height. They're now protected characteristics under the city's human rights laws. More than 40% of American adults are considered overweight, and studies show that prejudice is widespread. Tegan Leckler is from the National Association to Advance Fat Acceptance. She says just being able to sit down can be difficult, and this new law will help.
In classroom settings, there are sometimes chairs where it's like people of a certain body size can fit into said chair, but then people of a larger body size are unable to fit into that chair. And really what this bill would do is just make it so that in public education spaces or public medical spaces, public transportation, etc., maybe you have a couple chairs that don't have arms on them so that people with larger body size can sit in them.
Well, Alex Ritson found out more about this law with our correspondent in New York, Samira Hussein.
People can't say, well, I don't want to hire a certain person because of their height or their weight. Or, you know, I'm not going to rent my house to this person because I'm worried that because of their weight, they might add extra wear and tear to their building. And these are some comments, actually, that some of the people who testified in favor of this bill had made about the kinds of comments that they had received.
But how would you prove it? Because no one actually says that when they say, no, you can't have the apartment, do they?
Right. So it's the difference between implicit bias and overt bias. But you see that kind of bias happening in every aspect. You know, if you're a person of color like myself, do you know that someone is saying, well, I don't want X, Y, or Z because of your color or because of your religion? You don't. But it is that implied kind of bias. And by setting up this law, what advocates are saying is that it really helps to start these conversations about what weight is and what height is.
So how much evidence is there that this is going on, not just in New York, but across the US more generally?
There have been some studies done that shows that, you know, in New York City, for example, 2 million people have been the victim of some sort of weight bias in the year 2019. And it actually comes at a financial cost. In New York, it cost $6.4 billion in that year. And that money is actually lost in terms of the lost wages by that individual because they're discriminated against and therefore they get paid less, which is also some of the evidence of these studies. And then it's also, you know, the lost spending that because they are made to feel badly about themselves, they don't go out. And what's interesting about this new rule is that it actually comes under the city's civil rights bill, and it makes it on the same level as race or religion or gender.
So, Samira, this is a civil rights issue, isn't it?
They have framed it as a civil rights issue, and this is part of a bigger movement to try and have more conversations about weight discrimination. Now, New York City is the largest city to have passed this kind of bill, but not the only city. And Michigan State has said that you cannot discriminate on the basis of weight. And there are other states that are considering legislation. And obviously, advocates here are hoping that New York State would also do that and eventually move on to the federal level.
Samira Hussein. A new book on the history of East Germany has come out. Beyond the Wall, East Germany, 1949 to 1990, is by British German historian Katja Heuer and recounts the stories of ordinary lives in a state that disappeared more than three decades ago, but whose impact has certainly not disappeared. The BBC's Michael Rossi takes up the story.
I think there is still a sense that West Germany was the real Germany, and then East Germany is the anomaly, that is the artificial thing that came and went.
Katja Heuer has written a fascinating new book on the history of East Germany, Beyond the Wall, in which she seeks to recount the everyday lives of ordinary citizens of the now defunct state.
In the American sector, massive tanks and armoured vehicles are poised within 100 yards of the East Berlin boundary. Their guns.
A BBC news report from the day the Berlin Wall went up in August 1961. The German Democratic Republic spied upon its own people to an extent not known before or since. One of those who suffered at the hands of the state was Stefan Wolle, now head of the GDR Museum in Berlin, but in the early 1970s, a history student at Humboldt University in East Berlin. Despite not broadcasting his anti-government opinions loudly, someone did denounce him. He knows who it was. He was forced to go and work in a factory for a year and could only reapply for admission to university with the approval of the state. For Stefan, how they responded to his situation and others like him who the state considered antagonistic all depended on what they wanted.
Me too. I was denounced. That depended on different coincidences, the way the party leaders reacted to it. When it suited them or was convenient for them, they played up the situation. If it didn't suit them, they swept it under the carpet. And later, it was not that convenient anymore. I now was educated, and the black sheep had returned to the flock. There they, of course, couldn't admit that everything was just a mask.
Dr. Stefan Wolle, talking about his experiences of being denounced as a student in the 1970s. The government of the GDR, whilst also cracking down on its own citizens, was also intriguingly sensitive at times to their problems, wanting to offset more protest.
One example is the coffee crisis in the 70s, where they realise actually they're struggling to import coffee. There's a worldwide shortage that becomes very expensive. And the government responds to that by bringing out this immense development project in Vietnam where they're trying to set up coffee plantations in a fellow socialist state, you know, knowing that this will take at least a decade to come to fruition.
Historian Katja Heuer, author of Beyond the Wall. Theresa, a young British language teacher from London, decided to move to Dresden in 1984 to experience life as an English language assistant at the university. But it was in a queue for a concert that she met her future husband, Olaf.
For me, it was a revelation that you could go to the opening of an art exhibition in a little gallery where, you know, it was really kind of interesting stuff. I would never have had that opportunity, I think, here in London, because I just didn't know those kind of people and I would have felt really out of place.
I'm sure there was a kind of awareness that Shazi would watch or have knowledge about it, but never intimidation, no problems at all. From our point, I would say I was left completely alone, apart from maybe one incident.
For Stefan Wolle, there's nothing to be missed from the days of East Germany. For Theresa and Olaf, whilst they wouldn't want the state back, they do miss some aspects of the life they experienced in the German Democratic Republic.
I can really say I feel privileged that I had a chance to live in a different system where things were not ideal. A lot of things were also wrong. But it's an experience which, right up to today, helps me to be who I am. And I'm grateful for this.
The height of the Cold War, to be sort of on the territory of what was supposed to be our enemy, and these people were just like us.
For Katja Heuer, German unity is a work in progress, not a big bang moment. And she feels that a lack of understanding has hindered this work.
For East Germans, both positive and negative, everything changed. There wasn't really any effort to try and reintegrate actively East Germans into a system that they had not ever experienced. And I think there was no understanding at the time or now for what that actually meant psychologically, economically, and politically.
That report was by Michael Rossi. Now, in a bid to get more views on YouTube, a man in California has admitted to intentionally crashing his aeroplane. The video posted on YouTube in December of 2021 currently has 2.9 million views. But now, Trevor Jacob, a pilot and skydiver, could face up to 20 years in prison. The newsroom's Phoebe Hobson has more.
The footage is really dramatic. It shows Trevor Jacob springing from a small aircraft over mountainous terrain in California.
Holy f***. I'm over the mountains and I f***ing out of the engine out.
He free falls, opening his parachute and landing into a bush. Mr. Jacob then swears and thanks God for still being alive. Some YouTube viewers were already sceptical as he didn't initially try to land the plane safely. He also had cameras and a selfie stick on him at the time of the crash. He reported the crash to the National Transportation Safety Board, claiming he didn't know the location of the plane which crashed into Los Padres Forest. It was then revealed he did know and returned to the wreckage after filming. His pilot license has since been removed and he has agreed to plead guilty to one felony count of destruction and concealment with intent. In a plea argument, he argued he filmed the video as part of a product sponsorship deal. Content creation on YouTube can be a lucrative business if your video proves popular, but the industry has been criticised for people taking dangerous risks for views. In 2018, a woman in the US was jailed for shooting dead her boyfriend in a botched stunt they hoped would go viral. Mr. Jacob has not responded to the BBC's request for comment.
Phoebe Hobson. Astronomers have discovered what they believe to be the largest explosion ever detected. A team led by researchers at Southampton University in Britain says the blast was more than 10 times brighter than any known supernova, as our science correspondent Palab Ghosh explains.
The researchers report that this incredible cosmic event took place nearly 8 billion light years away. They believe that the explosion was a result of an enormous cloud of gas, possibly thousands of times larger than our sun, being swallowed up by a supermassive black hole. This would send shockwaves across space and leave superheated remnants of the cloud surrounding the black hole like a giant ring donut. The team's research, published in the monthly notices of the Royal Astronomical Society, suggests that the explosion has lasted more than 3 years. In comparison, most supernovas are visibly bright for only a few months. Nothing on this scale has been witnessed before. Researchers say that although such events are extremely rare, they could be an important process in the evolution of galaxies.
Palab Ghosh. It is nearly time for the grand final of the Eurovision Song Contest following Thursday's semi-final. Ukraine should have been hosting this event, but the war made that impossible, so it's taking place in the English city of Liverpool instead. The Ukrainian president, Volodymyr Zelensky, had hoped to make a video appearance to tens of millions of viewers calling for continued backing for his country in its struggle against Russian forces. But that request has been refused. Organisers said it would be against the competition's rules. But while the country's leaders will not be allowed to appear, Ukrainians and supporters are expected to be in the audience in Ukrainian colours and flags, as well as thousands of others in high spirits. From Liverpool, here's our entertainment correspondent, Colin Patterson.
Fans flocked to the second Eurovision semi-final.
Arms in the air!
There are 16 countries competing for the final 10 places in Saturday's contest, and there are a lot of Belgians.
They will definitely go to the finals and will ending up second.
That's a confident and very specific prediction.
Absolutely.
Experts said this was by far the weaker of the two semis, but Belgium's Gustav did indeed prove to be particularly popular in the arena. Austria's Thea and Selina sang about the ghost of the Gothic writer Edgar Allan Poe and the royalty rates writers receive from streaming services. A while the frontman of Australia's entry Voyager, Daniel Estrin, combines being a rock god with his day job as an immigration lawyer. And when it came to the results, which included the votes of people in the UK...
The last act through to the grand final is...
Meaning it was farewell to Romania, San Marino, Georgia, Iceland, Greece and Denmark, despite their entry, Riley's 10 million followers on TikTok. Now to the real business, tomorrow's grand final.
Well, not only are Ukrainian musicians involved in the entertainment, all sides of production, design, lighting, sound benefit from Ukrainian contribution as well. Elena Miloradova is a Ukrainian technical producer and is one of the many people who have travelled from the country to work behind the scenes. She told us how she's feeling ahead of tomorrow's final.
Of course, we are very disappointed that in Ukraine we still have terrified war. That was really hard even the last year when the war started and we had to go to Italy to the production period. Of course, last year we thought that we will host Eurovision in Ukraine, but as we cannot do that because of the safety reasons, right, we hope to bring more Ukrainian here to England so we could show what we may do. And also there are a lot of interval acts from Ukrainian creative team who shows how the war started in Ukraine, and a lot of people asking us how we are, what we are doing, where we live. And we still, all the team lives in Ukraine. Of course, it's really hard to go from the country abroad. For sure, it takes more time, and it's really hard to be not in the country, whereas your relatives, friends, everybody, and you keep searching the news every day to understand that they are alive and everything is okay with them. So this is hard, but for us it's also important to show that Ukraine is a very powerful country, and for sure we will stand on our rights. So I hope that the war will finish soon and the Eurovision will be in Ukraine as well.
That was the Ukrainian technical producer, Elena Miloradova. And that's all from us for now, but there will be a new edition of the Global News podcast later on. If you want to comment on this podcast or the topic that we've covered in it, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. You can also find us on Twitter, of course, @globalnewspod. This edition was mixed by Jack Graysmark. The producer was Iona Hampson. The editor is Karen Martin. I'm Nick Miles, and until next time, goodbye.
In 2008, 23-year-old Norwegian student Martina Vik Magnussen went missing after a night out with friends in London.
I wonder what on earth could have happened.
We were so obsessed with just finding her.
Then...
Police investigating the murder of a Norwegian socialite in central London.
Hours after her death, the only suspect in the case fled the UK to Yemen. His name is Farouk Abdelhak. He's never been questioned by the police. Nobody's been able to speak to him until now.
You got me like feeling a little bit sick to my stomach. I've never been open.
I'm Noelle McAfee, and I've been following this story since Martina was killed, making a promise to Martina's family to find out what happened. Murder in Mayfair. You can listen to the whole story now, right here in the documentary. Just scroll down and look for Murder in Mayfair.
Stream the new Paramount Plus original series, Fatal Attraction.
I didn't think that this is what we were doing.
What were we doing?
Starring Joshua Jackson, Lizzie Kaplan.
I'm not going to be ignored, Dan.
Fatal Attraction, now streaming exclusively on Paramount Plus.